This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I look forward to a new book by John Updike for a couple of reasons. One, of course, is that I want to read it. The other is that it gives me an occasion to invite him back for an interview. John Updike has a new novel I quite enjoyed called Memories of the Ford Administration. It's his first novel since the conclusion of his Rabbit series. Memories of the Ford Administration sounds like it should be a political memoir. Its publication date is Election Day, but it's not exactly what you'd expect. I'll let Updike explain the conceit of the novel.
Well, a professor of history at a New Hampshire college called Wayward College has been invited by a mythical organization called the New England, what is it called, Northern New England Association of American Historians. It's trying to get out a special issue on the Ford administration, and it requests his memories and impressions of the presidential administration of Gerald R. Ford for written symposium on same to be published in their tri-quarterly journal, Retrospect, or Retrospect. And my hero, Alf Clayton, obliges of his memories, but they tend to be personal. He was in a state of considerable erotic déshabille at the time, having left one wife and not quite latched on to the next. And also he begins to include more and more of a book he was trying to complete at the time about the 15th American president, James Buchanan, so that the book is alternates chapters of Alf's life during the mid-70s with Buchanan's total life focusing on the pre-Civil War administration. He was president from 1857 to 1861.
Why does this book, which seems like it will be a political memoir, really end up being a book about the sexual and family crises of one person in one specific period?
Well, because the Ford administration was a high watermark of sorts, or so I construe it, of the sexual revolution. It was pre-AIDS. The freedom had been established and was almost old hat, and the counter-revolution of the microbes hadn't occurred yet. So people were fairly sexy, and there was this general sexual seeking going on under Ford, as I keep saying, for which Jerry Ford, by the way, should not be blamed, although...
I'm sure he's blushing, though.
I wonder.
Not how he thought of his administration.
No, nor how we thought of it at the time. But looking back, it was a moment, a kind of a paradise that won't come soon again.
You are really wonderful at using sex to describe character, and it's not the first novel you've done this with. But let me ask you why you, especially in this novel, use sex to describe character.
I suppose one of my youthful theories when I was a beginning writer was that sexual behavior, like other behavior, was characteristic, and that the 19th century tradition of closing the bedroom door did shut us out from some revelations into how people behave, because people don't behave the same in bed as they do at the dining table. I don't know, and I guess it's a fairly deep self that declares itself in sex, and for that reason of interest to any novelist, I would imagine.
Let me ask you to read a passage that I think will kind of get a little bit at what we're talking about here. And this passage has several things. It's about sex and character. It's also, this whole book is the memoir, do you know what I mean, that this character is writing
right
for this historical society. Well, most, yeah.
Shall I try to begin this?
Yes,
this long passage? Alf has set himself up. This is me talking, by the way, not writing. In an apartment about a mile from the college where he teaches, and he has visitors. One of them is Wendy Wadley, who is a faculty wife, but not his wife. Let us begin. In the sudden shades down gloom, Wendy, suppressing her natural tendency to chatter, rapidly undressed down to her white underwear, which glowed like the soft strips of daylight below the canvas shade's brown hems. I did the same, mirroring her semi-abandon, keeping on my underpants for now, as if hesitating to unbandage a flaming wound. The ornate etiquette of screwing a woman for the first time. Does the lady expect a condom? Should one offer the use of the bathroom and use it oneself as before an extended auto trip? Are there any surface blemishes or peculiarities to be explained, lest they give alarm, or should we let the flesh speak for itself? The awkwardness takes us back to childhood, when one knows no accepted forms. In this abrupt closeness, a subtle but immensely actual novelty, in odor, in texture, in erotic slant, and an estimated experience and expectation, looms like an intimidating cliff. Though I had held Wendy in my arms at many a college dance, and in the groping latter stages of many a faculty get-together, when the host, to prolong the already distended evening, fishes out a forgotten Billy Eckstein LP, her body was basically strange to me. Her skin, the broad patch of it between her bra and panties, felt cooler than I had expected, and harder in its curves, especially the adjacent two of her prominent rump. I allowed myself the unprecedented liberty of caressing these through the silken sheath of her underpants, more bikini than I was accustomed to. It was considerate and perhaps cunning of Wendy to keep her underwear on. As a woman of my generation, she understood, as an undergraduate would not have, my need to be sheltered from too blindingly sudden an exposure to the glories of the female body. And the stimulus that underwear would be for me, with my long gradualist history of forbidden glimpses up a skirt or through a blouse armhole, and of backseat grapplings with resistant elastics and snaps. Or, why make a maneuver of it? She herself felt shy, and her sense of etiquette dictated reserving to a later stage of our session removal by trembling hands working in partnership of these last garments. For though this was 1974, we had not been born to its freedoms, but brought to them through the timidity and taboos of earlier eras.
I really like in the passage that you've just read the way you get at the conflict between the freedom and the self-consciousness of that era.
Well, I suppose of any era, in a way, sleeping with somebody has never been simple, and not even in the Ford era was it simple. And also, the Abstract reading it, the reference to earlier eras, after all, that these people were born in the 30s, they had some taste of Depression America, of wartime America, of a Puritan America, really, so that for them, these liberties and this sexual ease could not be taken for granted, as it presumably is by the undergraduates whom you mentioned, who were born when? In the 50s, I suppose.
Were there writers who you had read when you were coming of age who did what you were trying to do, or did you feel like you were exploring new territory?
Well, I was trying to take advantage of a frontier that had really be opened up. I can't claim to be the first adventurer on these frontiers of sexual explicitness, of sexual realism, as I like to think of it. Parts of Ulysses, for one, including the famous Molly Bloom soliloquy, showed me what sex should be in a book. It should be in there and should be bluntly and really and hotly there, but at the same time should be embedded in a lot of other reality that isn't sexual. I had read that. I read Henry Miller. I read Lady Chatterley, of course, and I read Lolita by Nabokov, all of which came out in the late 50s, early 60s, so that by the time I wrote Rabbit Run, the promised land of total sexual explicitness was there, but I wasn't quite ready to enter it and did have a little trouble with that text, but no text since.
What changed for you?
I think the world changed in that what was daring in Rabbit Run within five years had become quite tame. Couples, which came out in 68, was a much more explicit book, and there was no question of running it the way I'd written it. It just—I think the point had been one that a writer is entitled to describe what is, whether what is sex or going to the bathroom or bank accounts or anything else. That is, the human experience should be fully available to the writer of fiction.
I'm glad you brought up going to the bathroom, because there's usually a bathroom near the bedroom in which the partners in your new novel are having a sexual encounter. And I really like the way you do that, since, I don't know, in a lot of more romanticized or descriptions of sexuality, that bathroom would never be there, if you know what I mean. It's a kind of part of reality that you're bringing into it.
Bathrooms do tend to be next to bedrooms, right. And bathrooms are very important in our lives, and we shouldn't omit them. You know, I'm reminded when I was young and impressionable, there's a Hemingway novel called The Have and Have Not, in which one character, a female character, accuses a male character, "You taught me that sex is what hangs behind the bathroom door." And that always stuck in my mind, I think, and reminds me that sex is a kind of plumbing and that sex and plumbing are very closely allied.
I want to quote a couple of things that you write in this book. You write, "Everything was out of the closet, every taboo broken, and still God kept his back turned, refusing to set limits." And you write, "The Ford era was a time of post-apocalyptic letdown, of terrifying permissiveness." Do you think freedom makes a lot of people nervous?
Oh, yes. Kierkegaard called it dreadful freedom, and it is dreadful. There was something very cozy about the limits that society placed upon sex, and we all missed them to a degree. And, of course, some are coming back. Yeah, I think that the sexual liberty was frightening because there went with it a kind of there was no longer the freedom to be unsexy. We all had to get with it, those of us of a certain age at least. There was a general feeling that there was a great deal of sexual treasure out there being exploited by entrepreneurs, and that anybody with any savvy at all should be getting on the bandwagon. So in a way it was a bit of a drag, I think, maybe for men and women both, more for women perhaps than for men.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Updike. His new novel is called Memories of the Ford Administration. Two of the themes that have really preoccupied you in your fiction are sexuality, but also spirituality, God, questions of religion. So it's both the carnal and the spiritual. Do you see that as a contradiction, or do the two like come together for you in revealing like two different sides of human nature or whatever?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say that the life force is quite keenly felt in the sex drive and also in the drive toward immortality, which is what takes people to church by and large, that these kinds of ecstasy offer some grounds for supposing that we are immensely important, that we're not just little two-legged bugs occupying the earth for a few decades, but are, you know, there's something momentous, that there is, in fact, a spiritual dimension to our lives, and sex is one doorway into that room and religion another.
I want to get back to the era of the 70s and the late 60s for a moment. It was primarily like the baby boom generation who was at the forefront of the sexual changes of that period. You have been writing about that, and you've also kind of experienced it on some level, although you were slightly older than the generation at the center of that. And I wonder if you felt at all envious of younger people or disturbed by them or whatever, being somewhat on the cusp?
Yeah, I don't feel envious now. I'm not sure what I felt in the 60s. It is true that my generation, the 50s, who were young in the 50s, and in my case in the mid-50s, I was 21 and 53, were relatively tame and repressed. At the same time, repression creates energy and excitement. We didn't have the terrible hangover that the 60s generation did either. And enough of the counterculture, enough of the sexual movement drifted upward into the older ages that I by no means felt deprived. In a way, my generation was lucky. A man in my Harvard class, Ted Hoagland, said that we were the best situated to enjoy the changes of the last 50 years because we still had a kind of innocence when we began, and yet we were young enough to be deflowered, as it were, by the revolution.
My guest is John Updike. His new novel is called Memories of the Ford Administration. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Updike, and he has a new novel called Memories of the Ford Administration. It wasn't until I read this new novel that I knew that I found out that you had written a book about James Buchanan yourself. I think of you as somebody who's, in a lot of ways, chronicled your times through fiction. What made you want to go back and write history?
Well, maybe a feeling that I'd chronicled enough of my own little generation, and a writer is always looking for the next book and trying to explore his own frontiers to a certain, much as he can. The historical novel has many troubles with it, especially for a realist writer as I claim to be. The fact that you can't exactly know what people said or what things tasted like or what rooms were like is to me a great barrier, and that's why the first Buchanan book was a play. But after all, the past is embedded in the present. It's all around us, in the buildings and our memories and our parents and our grandparents. I had grandparents that lived to be quite old, so I had a good sense of time reaching back. So in a way, Buchanan was just at the far edge of my possible experience. There was something about him that spoke to me and seemed in a way personal.
I've been meaning to ask you something about writing metaphors or analogies. You use them when you use them so well. I'll just read an example of one that I just kind of particularly like. This is an example from your new novel of, your main character is is making love for the first time to the mother of one of his former students. And he says about her, "She bestowed herself upon me with the amused efficiency of a suburban mother laying out a big tray of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for her children and their playmates on a Saturday afternoon." Now, does something like that just come to you, or do you sit down and try out five or six of them and kind of carefully construct it? I know for myself, like, I'm the kind of person who does not think in analogies. They do not come to me. And so I'm just curious if this is something that you work on, or if it just...
It kind of just comes, actually. And when it doesn't come, you should try to do without the metaphor.
Right.
I've been writing so long, I have a kind of inner rhythm now that dictates when the metaphor is going to come. And maybe it's not a good thing. I mean, I keep trying to shake myself up as a writer. I early read Proust in English, and he is the great creator of metaphors and of linking two unlike things in this magical way. So I suppose that's the influence of Proust. Two unlike things that mutually illuminate each other is the idea of a metaphor, and by and large, it's like dialogue. You kind of listen for it, and if it comes, you write it down, and if not, you move on.
Now, is this the kind of thing that only comes when you're writing, or do you kind of drift through the world seeing these analogies as they happen?
I don't really see them much, I don't think. In fact, I see rather little as I go through life. It's only when I sit down at the desk that I become a writer and a seer in any sense. I occasionally think of plot developments when I'm in the car or walking along, but the actual texture of the writing you more or less have to do while you're there. It's a kind of a music, and you have to be into it, and then it begins to happen and chime, and who knows where it comes from.
We last spoke on the air right after the announcement was made that Tina Brown was going to be the new editor of The New Yorker magazine. You've had several pieces in there since then, a couple of fiction pieces, a review of Camille Paglia's new collection of essays. How does the new New Yorker feel to you so far?
It's been very hospitable to me, as you say, and she's been very flattering and kind, and I've always loved The New Yorker and will intend to contribute as long as they want me. Since I grew up on the format of the Sean era, it doesn't do much for me to see the names at the top and the type bigger and so on. But if it opens it up somehow for younger readers, I don't see that it does any essential harm. That is, the words are still the same. And the old New Yorker, in many ways, seems to survive under the new New Yorker. I think, to her credit, she's trying to do a very hard job of pouring old wine into a new bottle without spilling too much of the old wine. The magazine seems to be livelier in a way, and all those little jumpy sections she's added now perhaps make it easier to get into. The New Yorker used to come to the house and you'd look at it and read the poems. This is me. Read the poems and the book review and then put it down, waiting when you had an hour to really look at it. And now the magazine kind of invites you in 5-minute snatches, and maybe that's the way we read now.
It's been, a couple of years now since Rabbit died in your last Rabbit novel. How does it feel now to have that much distance on the character?
Well, I'm a little sorry that he fell so ill. He doesn't quite die in the novel, but he certainly seems to be dying, and He was, as I said at the time, he was very good to me, and I hated to do it to him. I did feel like he was a kind of a brother, and I was giving him a lot of hard knocks. But life is like that. I am God, as far as those characters go, and God gives us hard knocks, so why should I spare Rabbit his own hard knocks? I think it was the right way to wind up those four novels. He was a man who was going to die early, somehow, as ex-athletes often do, somehow. If you've peaked at 18, I think it's hard to keep rolling happily until you're 80. Although some people do it, I miss him in a funny, faint way. But he is only a character. Let's not remember. I'm still here, and I'm still trying to write.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier. What you described as the theistic outlook. In talking about the freedom of the sexual freedom of the 70s, and talking about how you've written about both sex and religion, I'm wondering if you ever in your life experienced great feelings of kind of like religious guilt over new behavior, or great kind of religious confusion as times got more free about what was the appropriate way to behave.
Yeah, I probably have. I feel sort of guilty all the time, actually, so it's hard to pick out any peaks of guilt. But the bad thing about sexual freedom is that it shakes up existing arrangements, and there are a lot of innocent bystanders, or we call them innocent. I mean, who's innocent? But relatively innocent bystanders who get shaken up in a sexual rearrangement. So that, I think, is where I felt guilty whenever I was asking anybody to make allowances or to change houses. A writer is somebody who's... this writer is afraid to intercede too boldly in the fabric of what is. You would rather write about it and manipulate it in that way than actually go out and change things and challenge people and upset houses. So yes, any time the sex slopped over into the real world, I felt badly.
John Updike, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Updike's new novel is called Memories of the Ford Administration. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.